another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Brantley Smith, former member of IHOP KC. Brantley, it's good to talk through this subject that you've chosen for today. I've debated on how to bring this out, but we've mentioned a few times that IHOP KC was just literally Branhamism 2.0. And I know that I get a little bit of pushback from people who are in the NAR community, because if you study the Branham doctrines and compare it to IHOP KC doctrines, they are quite a bit different. In fact, the idea of what you had as revival and the idea of what we had as revival, it's slightly different, because Branham believed in a pre-tribulation rapture and there was no need for an end of the days conquering. But if you understand the timeline of events and how things came to be, you begin to understand that there were men who noticed that something's wrong here. Branham had certain things that we believed to be true, and then other things, he missed the mark. So within that variance of missing the mark is what actually birthed what you came out of. So I want to talk through this. It's going to be a little bit delicate and tricky, and I know I'll get a lot of pushback even from, you know, from the Branham side and from the IHOP KC side, because doctrinally speaking, they're a little bit different. But if you look at the architectural framework that was established, it was literally Branhamism 2.0, led by Mike Bickle, but also by Paul Kane, who was William Branham's protege. So there's a lot of tie-ins here, and I'm going to do my best to try to untangle this for you, and we'll see where it goes.
I'm very excited to hop in this conversation and selfishly ask you some questions, I guess, is kind of the angle that I want to take this today. You always are interviewing people about their experiences and stuff, but you're like such an expert on this thing. And anytime in our little support groups that we have and things, and people come up with a question, they're always like, we need to ask John this. And so today I'm going to ask you some stuff. But and maybe the revival thing's a good place to start at. I was digging around in some stuff this week, two different things that kind of got my mind turning this way. One was an old from the CIA reading room. We're going to go real crazy real quick. Was one of those covert action magazines, which I know that you've seen before. We've had a conversation about that, was talking about the religious right and such. And then I was reading an old transcript of Mike Bickle's from a One Thing conference, one of the first One Thing conferences. And what was shocking about reading that opening session from one of the first One Thing conferences was Mike's big recruitment message that was like central to it. He knew that people were coming in enamored by this idea. Revival was a big part of that, because people, like, that's like the golden calf in charismatic circles. But the thing that I think fascinates me the most about these conversations is not even the doctrinal side of it, but more, I guess we can use the word authoritarianism, of how it sets up these cultures for control. If we use the C word, the cult word, as I've looked at in just the short time I've been looking into this, these different groups that exist and offshoots, even from IHOP KC world, they may have their doctrinal or belief differences, but whenever you look at the structures of them and the methods that they use, one of the hallmarks of the houses of prayer is that they get cheap, unpaid labor. It's a big part of it. And so they use some of those same tactics to talk people into walking away from careers, walking away from going to college, to sign up to do these things. And I know for me personally, and maybe this is how we started talking about revival, is I grew up in an Assembly of God church, which is obviously another offshoot of sorts. Is revival was like the number one goal. Like that was seen as the target destination. And what I realized though was that people never really thought much past a revival meeting, in a sense, that the revival was supposed to be this big transformational thing. But in my time, in my circles, all that meant was that we were having extended meetings and everybody was coming to the church every night. And living through a small version of that during my time at IHOP, that does a number to your nervous system and causes certain things to happen. But I'm curious, like what was that idea of revival in the context of Branhamism? Was it such a golden calf like it was in the NAR circles I was in?
Well, first, let me unpack what is Branhamism, because I think that's a complex box that if you don't really understand that, you can't understand how the architecture works. So to almost every statement that you could make in the form of a question that you could ask me, does Branham side with this or does he side with another group? The answer is almost universally going to be both, because he spoke through both sides of his mouth and he kept reinventing himself over and over. So we had groups. Remember, when this thing started, what they were attempting to do initially was to try to suck people out of the mainstream denominations. They had a doctrine that mainstream churches were cold and formal, they had become apostate, and we need a new thing. And so what essentially that is, if you understand it, it is birthing a new religion. So we need a new religion. We don't like the old one. That was the premise. So they sucked people in from Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, pretty well across the board. They were sucking people in. Well, what you ended up with was this weird scenario where to be a leader in this fivefold ministry concept, you could lay hands on somebody and feel the power strike through their hands into the individual, and then suddenly they're a new leader. Whether they're qualified, whether they're fit for ministry, whether they're a predator, you just had this weird thing where there was no boundaries. The Assemblies of God stopped and said, no, this is wrong. You guys can't do this. We need at least some credentials. And that was early. That was like 1949. But what happened is they sucked all these people in, but they had no system of accountability. And worse, they had no governing authority over them. So you suck in a Baptist who's part of the Latter Rain End of Days Revival. He's going to preach with a Baptist flair. Bring a Methodist, they're a Methodist flair. Bring a Pentecostal, it's like a Pentecostal in extremism steroids. It's really weird when you think about it. Now, broaden that to today, as this thing has evolved over time. You had groups that believed in an end of days revival, which my group oddly did in a way, which I'll qualify that in a second. And you had other groups that didn't believe it at all. Branham's dead. This is it. We're waiting for the rapture, etc. And that is because as this evolved, people took their own theologies and tried to adapt it to the prophecies that he made. And that's where I really want to head with this before we get into the broader discussion of revival. There's a passage from Deuteronomy, 18, I think it is. It says, whenever a prophet speaks, and I'm going off of memory in the old King James English, when he speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken. The prophet spoke it presumptuously. And here's the key, you shall not be afraid of him. In the Bible, in the ancient world, the prophets were something to be a little bit feared of because they were God's mouthpiece. And if they're speaking with the authority of God, and then the prophecy doesn't come to pass, this verse really labels them as a false prophet. They're speaking presumptuously. It's out of their own mouth, out of their own mind. And you can ignore this guy. Don't be afraid of him. God did not speak. This movement, with Branham spearheading it, changed things in a weird way. So when a prophecy was given, it was extremely vague so that they could try to come in later and make it fit. And if it never could fit, they would just strip out elements of the prophecy and say, this is the thing. This is what fit. One of the prophecies Branham had early on was that Mussolini was the Antichrist, and he was going to bring in the end of days, yada, yada, yada. Well, he was siding with the Christian Identity people, and he died not quite like Branham said, and that prophecy morphed into a different end of days prophecy, which if you go to charisma.com, you can read the list of seven. There's no mention of Mussolini as being the Antichrist, but it morphs and shifts, and the people morph and shift with it. That's the thing to understand. This is coming at a time whenever tent revivals were really big, and they were coming out of, there were people who were connected to the Christian Missionary Alliance, which had an end of days big revival, worldwide revival type theme with them. And Branham has key figures working with him that were part of the Ministerial Alliance. So what happens is the tent revivalists go out. They get the biggest tent. They're all fighting for the biggest tent. Who can get the biggest tent? Who can bring the biggest revival? And it is kind of like that, what IHOP KC had, in that they believed that they would bring this big revival, they would convert the world, and then Jesus would come. But what happened was, as you entered into the modern age, past the radio, now you're getting into the television age, things changed quite a bit. Nobody really wanted to go sit in a hot tent in the summer, and you can sit right in your living room and watch it on TV, right? So there was a point in time in which this began to shift, and you can see the prophecies begin to shift as well, and then Branham dies. So Everybody who is believing in his prophecies, which are about tents, that was the big revival, end of days revival thing for me. There would be this great big massive tent. Branham would go around the world, and he would go around the world once, and you would either hear it or you were lost forever. Very similar to what you had at IHOP KC, except for it wasn't a tent.
No, it was Paul Kane stadiums. Like, that's what it was. Yeah,
exactly.
Real quick.
Exactly. So Paul Kane is key to this, to understand. So the prophecy is given. It's excessively vague. It doesn't happen. Rather than heed the advice of the Bible, this thing that this guy spoke was presumptuous. It doesn't come from me. Be afraid of him. What they try to do is they try to reinterpret it in different ways. So Paul Kane is actually mimicking Branham's original vision that there would be this big tent revival, which ironically half of Branhamism doesn't even believe anymore. And he just reinterpreted it to be a stadium. Now we're going to have a stadium, not a tent. But he's missing the key part. In Branham's version of the vision, there would be this little room in the corner of the tent. And if you were lucky enough to get it, to get into that tent, and you were lucky enough to get to that room, you'd be given your new bodies and you would step into the kingdom.
There was an element of that with the stadiums. You just triggered the memory, was that there was a tent of healing is what it was, that they were talking about people being taken in on stretchers into this little tent, and then they would come out healed. And that was like part of the no disease known to man would stand before this people. So that was like a little repackage, it sounds like.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Remember, this is an unusual world up until Branham died. If you go to Voice of Healing magazine and you look at any of the magazines, you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people in these big revivals. You're going to see hundreds, if not thousands, of ministers who are all joined into this, believing that William Branham was Branham and his movement and his theology was the biblical return of Jesus Christ. And T.L. Osborne, who's big in the Word of Faith, Prosperity Gospel, worked very closely with Kenneth Hagin, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, you can go find his actual statement on my website, but he says something to the effect, I don't care if you think I'm sacrilegious, but we just saw God come down in human flesh in William Branham. Well, they believed that this was it. This was the big revival. We're going to have the big revival. And then he died. So what do you do with this? You either call him a false prophet, and all of this money that we have collected for this big movement that we have, we collected in error, and we have to give back to the people, or we just simply say, well, he got it right. We just didn't understand it, so let's change some of the details.
Yes. Yeah. I was privy to a conversation that I won't say who the parties were, but it was around the changing of the IHOP prophetic history, and why certain leaders didn't blow a whistle about it, specifically with, and I know that you've talked about it in different times on here, was with the death of Mike's brother, Pat Bickle, which was central to a lot of the prophetic history of Kansas City. Like, him being healed was going to be like a sign of like the revival's come kind of thing. And so whenever he died, which I think was like mid-2000s, like 2004 to 2007, somewhere in that time frame, it caused great disillusionment in the community, because it's like, what do we do with this now? And in this conversation I was privy to, was this guy was like, well, Mike had told me privately, like as far back as 1993, that Pat's healing was whenever he died and was, you know, eternally got his new body and all this kind of stuff, and he was healed at that point, and that was going to be the thing. But then it's like, but still, those things that you said were going to happen didn't happen. Like, you know, it's these reinterpretations. And you see it with the Super Bowl prophecies. There was so many Super Bowl prophecies about the Chiefs, and I think it's I think if there is a such thing as divine providence and little God winks that happen, I think it's that the Chiefs have turned into the Patriots of the 2015s, 2020s, up to where that they're winning every other Super Bowl or appearing in every Super Bowl, and that they've won what, like three, and we still haven't seen, you know, any kind of revival. Was there a whole lot of competition, like land grabbing, I guess, with these tent revivals? I see in some of these movements I'm looking at, and I know it happened within the Kansas City Prophet days, to where these leaders would come in and they saw other ministries or revival lists, if we use that term, as competition in a sense. So they like kind of did whatever they could to get rid of them. And what was most common was that they would absorb them in a sense. Now I'm seeing prophecy used as a tool a whole lot, of almost like coming under this apostolic covering of Mike Bickle or whoever. Were those kind of tactics being used like in the tent revivals or in different aspects of Branhamism?
You know, for me, that's one of the most interesting parts of all of this. When you think about religion as it has been presented by the movement, they're showing you these pictures of these massive crowds and this massive gathering. Everybody's coming into this big city, and it looks good. It sells. Especially, I had this conversation with Bob Scott. You go to some developing nation, and if you tell them that there's going to be dinner on the ground, you'd attract people for 100 miles, man. People would just come to this. And then you got this great photo opportunity. But here in the States, it's a little bit different. The people are spread out. You have the rural people, and they wouldn't necessarily come for food. But then it begs the question, why the cities? If I were a God and I was looking at my people and I was looking at the earth, and there's this massive, you know, grouping of people in this massive city, well, does that mean that I forget about the mom and pop who are out in the rural country on the farm? Do I not care about those people? And I've thought about the revivalists, and it's just so odd, because the revivalists targeted places where they could get big numbers in the revival, and they could get a photograph of the big numbers. They didn't go to the middle of the nowhere in the farm and say, tell your neighbors, the end is coming, the end is nigh, the revival is here, join the revival, because there wasn't numbers, there wasn't money. It just, from a logistical standpoint, it really wouldn't have even worked. And so then I was faced with the question, well, does God care about logistics? And none of it made any sense to me. So as I'm looking through, you know, the development from the difference in the technological advances of the era, they would target whatever was the current advance that would give them the most people, which would by default give them the most money, sometimes the most power, and in the worst cases, more sex. And it's always those three: money, power, and sex. If you can get that, you're going to attract some leader of some sort. And remember, these are leaders that simply, if you lay your hand and do the wizard thing on them, they can suddenly become a fivefold leader too. So you can't really trust that they have the right intention. Some of them did, but you can't trust that all of them did. The ones that target the big cities and forgot about the people out on the farm, I'm really bothered by this, because if I wanted to tell people the end of the world is here, I truly believe it's here, and I want everybody who can be saved to be saved, there's no way I would avoid demographics of people. I would go to every single person that I could possibly go to. And that's not what they did.
And that's a very Christ-like idea, though. I mean, like the scripture tells us, he leaves the 99 to go after the one. And so like that's like, I think it's where we see like this almost capitalism influence of Christianity that I think goes broader than the movements we're talking about, to where it becomes, you know, where can we have the biggest impact instead of a single person, a single human being valuable. One of the things you brought up and kind of alluded to, you talked about Voice of Healing, which was one of the things that came up whenever I was reading the, I don't know if you can hear, I got construction going down. So if you guys hear weird noises, that's what's going on. They're remodeling the apartment below me.
I just thought you had Taco Bell.
That could be too. the Voice of Healing, and it talked about the radio stations, and I'm thinking about the you have to put yourself in the time period, like to now, like you hear somebody say they have a radio station, you think that there's some kind of nut job in a back room. But at that time, as you're saying, it was cutting edge. Like that's how you had mass appeal, mass effect, the equivalent of doing like a live stream today is what it made me think of. It made me think of, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the camera system that they had at IHOP was only used by two other companies in the world. It was a big motorized thing and they ran 24/7 along with these people. It was, I think it was CNN and NASA that had this camera system. And so like that became a very big tool for recruiting. That's how I got connected early on. After I heard the IC Stadium's prophecy, and that kind of drew me in as a worship leader, the nameless faceless stuff. And then, I started paying the $20 a month of my own money I was making at the grocery store working in the evenings to subscribe to the live stream. And I would watch it every night or put it on as I was going to sleep or something and just listen to it and fall asleep to it. But the thing that shocked me was it seemed like that these other people realized the power of these radio stations. It talked about these radio stations being bombed, which is nuts. How was radio used? Like, was it used as like a gathering tool, like a recruitment tool? Like what were they doing? They were playing as teachings and those kind of things.
The funny part about it is Branham did not really care so much about himself on the radio. What he really wanted, he thought more from a high level organizational standpoint. He was very open to other people doing the things for him. So like even the recordings of his sermons, it wasn't him or his, he didn't even own rights to the recordings, which is really odd. Wow. He had other people who did, because what he cared about was gathering the crowds. If other people did the work, he didn't have to pay for a team. And there were people who just like volunteered. I'll record all your sermons, I'll travel with you, but I want to sell them myself. And so they got an incentive. They're selling it thinking they're going to get rich, which some of them had a little bit of money, not much. But what would happen is that was advertising material for people to come to his meetings. If you're sick and you're afflicted, well, come, you'll get healed, which a lot of people came and not many people did from what I can gather. Radio was much the same way. There were stations that played him. I've identified some stations that played him, but he wasn't as big of a radio voice as some of the other guys. What he did instead was he would get with some of the other famous radio voices, and so they would talk about him, they would advertise him, etc. So he's like in an upper tier above all of this, and then you had a layer beneath that was really doing all the legwork for him. And I don't know if that was Branham's strategy or if he just simply didn't care, but when you mix Branham with Gordon Lindsay, who did have an organizational mind, Lindsay is really orchestrating the business side of Branham. Mm. And he turned Branham's magazine, The Voice of Healing, it was initially just simply to advertise Branham because his nickname was America's Voice of Healing. Mm. And he had a column in a Pentecostal magazine called The Voice of Healing. He was an editor in it, which there's a little bit of oddity there. This is a man who's supposed to be illiterate, who didn't have a seventh grade education, who barely can speak, but he's an editor of a magazine. So it's a little bit weird. The stage persona shifted and turned far more fictional. But what he did was he connected with Lindsay. Lindsay created a structure in which if you were part of this organization, you were heavily advertised in the magazines, you were part of the events, you might even have, I don't know if you had a booth or what, but you could distribute all of your materials, etc. And the better part is, which there's a little bit of gray here, and I wish somebody on the inside would reach out to me, but they were collecting names and addresses, not only for the subscriptions, but they would also have things like, we would love to send your sick friend a copy of Voice of Healing. Give us their name and address and whatever is ailing them. Well, if you've got names and addresses and you've got a movement that has literally told people that guessing your names and addresses is a thing of God, you start to piece this together, right? That it really, James Randi, who is a famous magician who left the magician field to show some of these stage tricks that they were doing, magician's tricks, he was uncovering all this kind of stuff. And I look back at it and I question the validity of it. But there was a strategy. So back to your question, radio was used, but in Branhamism, it was more used to develop the movement. and not just Branham alone. Branham was the publisher of Voice of Healing until Lindsay finally took it over completely. But they were advertising Mini Men, and they did have some radio sections in there. It was more about, let's grow the movement. And if you understand how that works, if you have a business mind, you start to understand that there's a guy at the top or one or two guys at the top, and it turns into this pyramid structure. Yeah. Where if you're at the bottom, you get in. Well, the people at the top are the ones making all the money. And that's kind of how this seemed to work.
Yeah, that layered structure existed at IHOP. And I was reading an article about the stuff happening with Bethel that we've been talking about with Alwyn on those episodes lately. That there's even examples, apparently reports within Bethel, that the students would actually pay to intern for leaders, is what it was. So like they would be students, but then they would have to pay to, and they would have to pay for their own plane tickets to travel with them and all these different things. But it was this access kind of thing. There was this whole second layer of leadership at IHOP that existed that was... The way that they made their money was profiting off the network is what it was, which sounds very similar as you're saying this. I'm connecting dots in my head of how this looked in my context, that there were certain leaders. I think about the Dave Slykers, the Alan Hoods, different ones who I remember would travel frequently, not accusing anyone of anything, but they would travel to these different things, and that's how they made their livings, was going on these itinerant circuits on the weekends. I think that was a really big reason too why Mike would have Friday night services too, because people would be gone over the weekends doing ministry and stuff. Whenever I started looking at it a different way yesterday, I was having this thought of, I was thinking back through IHOP U, and these same guys were teaching these IHOP U classes during the week. So your Allens, your Corey Russells, these different ones. And what was funny is they would sell you textbooks for these classes that were published by these guys. So whenever they would have a class, not only would they get a stipend from IHOP U, which we've heard Alan Hood talk about in his own testimonies, that he was in poverty pretty much his whole time at IHOP, but they would get paid their stipend from IHOP U, but then every student that enrolled in that class was buying their book, and they were making a cut off of the book as well. So it was like kind of like you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of culture. And IHOP did so many services. Like Mike did share the platform a lot, which is kind of surprising now, I guess, like in hindsight, like knowing what is, I guess, been revealed about Mike through stories and testimonies and things like that, is that he wasn't more protective over that. But I guess it was used as a tool as well for him to control people, to be able to give them that platform time. But yeah, that broader social network that opens up is what allows these guys to keep going, is what I'm realizing too. So like there is a whole segment of IHOP KC leaders that after Mike Bickle's allegations went public, they dropped off the map, and like we're seeing them pop back up in different places, at a pastor of a local church, or connected with this house of prayer in Dallas, or wherever it might be. But you realize that there's like real benefits for these things for these people. I'm kind of circling back a little bit if it's okay, but one of the things I was surprised to read, which I'd heard you talk about, but the dots weren't connecting with me, is dispensationalism, talking about dispensationalism being used. And I realized as I was reading through this Covert Action magazine, which for those who don't know, it kind of functioned as like a watchdog journal for intelligence operations and such. So these were investigative journalists that would publish articles. And this one I was looking at was specifically about the religious right. And so they were talking about these figures like Billy Graham. Tim LaHaye was one that like stood out to me because of the Left Behind books, were a big part of my childhood. But realized that these beliefs were grooming people for authoritarian control, is what it was. Yeah. What it was. And I don't know how else to say that in a more gentle way. Did you see I don't know if Branham was dispensationalist, but was like the doctrines and those kind of things, did that predispose people, like once they bought into the system, to be controlled? Like was that a thing?
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So that particular question could actually explode into 10 to 20 podcasts. Yeah. There's so much wrapped in that.
No, there is. There is.
So let me break it down, and this may take me a while. I'm gonna do my best to do it quickly and let you talk as well. But let's first address, you're talking about Bickle being with other people, and you're talking about ministers who are training ministers, this kind of thing. Think of it like your job. If you come in entry level at a job, you've got a boss. And that boss often will tell you to do things that you think are just absolutely absurd and ridiculous. And you push back against the boss and you see that next tier. That's all you can see, is that next tier. Well, above him is a boss who's telling him on a broader scale, I want all of these bosses to do these things for an overall agenda that the rank and file employee can't see. Well, they push back because you're pushing back, and the boss above them says, no, I have a strategy, and they may or may not give that full strategy. Above those people are more bosses, and there are organizations that are flat, which is the modern style, but there are older organizations that it's very much like a pyramid. Whenever you look at this movement and you look at how it developed, if you're thinking in terms of just your rank and file member Christian, and you see this strategy where you've got money, power, and sex, the people, you begin to understand people are their assets, but you only look at that one tier. You look at the Mike Bickle, you look at the Paul Kane, you look at whatever is that tier. But you have to understand there are levels above this, right? And some of those levels may include government, which I'll get into that in just a second. It's a little bit weird and scary. But think back to, so Branham and Gordon Lindsay, they would be in the levels above the ministers, and that's probably why Branham didn't care so much about radio. They were creating a new organization, a new denomination, and they were holding deliverance seminars, training people how to be in deliverance ministry. That's why deliverance ministry exists today. That was part of the Voice of Healing conventions. So these ministers would come into the conventions, ministers, evangelists, prophets, apostles, they would all come and learn how to cure the demon of hiccups and whatnot in these, in these conferences. And the minister, the leadership were the assets to the people above the leadership, if that makes any sense to you. And there were people above. This is a pyramid strategy, right? If you go back, you can find some videos of Branham preaching and healing the sick. There's this video, I think it's called Deep Call to the Deep, 20th Century Prophet. You can see on the platform behind him are all of these folding chairs of people on the platform with him. When Branham held a convention, it was not just him speaking. He would often be the Indact, you know, there'd be other ministers. Derek Prince is one of the ministers who introduced and said, William Branham's coming out in a few minutes. So you had all of these people who are connected. They're all working for an overall agenda. And the people sitting behind him, and likely even Derek Prince, they're kind of assets in this movement. They may not see themselves that way, and people who are in their cult of personality today may argue against this, but that's really what they were. So you had this business structure that was in the shape of a pyramid with leadership at the top. Now, take a step beyond this, and I'm going to go slightly into conspiracy theory. I avoid this a little bit. Where I will go is documented.
I'm here for it.
You've got people who have large audiences, who have a global footprint, who are going into nations where there may be government opportunities. And you may have government agents, sometimes undercover, sometimes not, who are working with religious leaders to feed them information and say, hey, while you're there, can you do this thing for me? And they may be friends, there may be some relationship. So there are instances, and I've looked at the Billy Graham stuff. I actually have, I've not published it. I've got a lot of the CIA stuff on Billy Graham. It's kind of funny. But there are opportunities and instances where a minister could be manipulated by the government without knowing they're manipulated by the government. And there are cases where the government just might say, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So there are things that happen like that. Is it insidious? Not really. But the minister who's doing it overseas won't likely know the entire operation that's going on by the government. So the government could be doing something that's just horrific, but the people who are ministers may only see one small piece of this. Richard Nixon is one of the famous ones. He was working with the Full Gospel businessmen who were largely Branhamites. I've got a photograph on the website of Branham in this National Prayer Breakfast meeting, and he's telling people that you ministers are our field agents today because the battle being fought against communism is a battle of the mind. We need you to step up and attack the battle of the mind. Not long after this, not long after Nixon gives them this charge, Branham comes up with this global end of days communism is going to destroy the world theme. Whereas prior to this, it was a Rome is going to destroy the world theme because they were against Romanism and, you know, all of the Klan stuff. So government sways prophecy. Government sways political ideas. You scratch your back, I'll scratch mine. Where it goes off into the weirdness, and I won't go too far with this, I do have some documents on the website. Branham's campaign manager, as he began to tour the world, was the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg, the adopted cousin of Werner von Blumberg, Hitler's Minister of Defense. And he had a foothold in Germany. He had huge connections in Germany. He was also a director on the Fellowship International, the family. He was also the director of Bob Jones University, or a director, I should say. He was also in a movement that was so strongly against homosexuals that they would brand people who were homosexuals as being unforgivable. And yet, he himself, the William T. Freire von Blumberg guy, was an avid homosexual, and the FBI tracked his male escorts coming into his room. So, and all that's documented, you can see it, you know, on the website. They cornered him and asked him, why are you doing this? Why are you spreading this movement? Or what is your religious faith? And he said, I don't do this for religion. Which is really, really odd if you think about what the fellowship is and the connections there. We've talked about Bethel, Doug Coe, is it in the fellowship, and he's working directly. He's in houses of famous people, right? So if you take a step back and look at all of this from an agenda standpoint, it's not even so much that the people who are doing the agenda are fully aware of what's going on because they don't have clearance to know the operation, but they know just enough where there is a collaboration. And if the minister or the evangelist has a political leaning towards the agenda, they will help further the agenda. And that's really the bottom line for this. This is the New Apostolic Reformation today, Branhamism, Latter Rain, and many of the elements that predated Branhamism was a merger of politics and religion. So to answer the question simply, yes, they may be doing some things. Yes, it may be for the CIA, but they may not be fully aware of what they're doing and why.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, because I was in that covert action thing. It was talking about the Contras and Pat Robertson's involvement. And there was like documented instances where I can't remember the specific. I think it was three leaders who traveled to the White House to meet with like the Secretary of State or something like that with this Guatemalan revolutionary leader. I can't remember. I know it's Mont something another who during the Guatemalan Civil War stuff, but they were talking about giving him resources, and Pat Robertson and them are pretty much like, well, we'll give him what he needs is like what it was. It went outside the government channels is the way that it alluded. And what was surprising to me as well is there was an account of I can't remember if it's a pastor or a missionary who went into Nicaragua and then was captured and interrogated because the Nicaraguan government was convinced that he was a CIA spy, which was like just the fact that they thought that that was a possibility, I think to me says that they've encountered that before, or they have good reason to believe that that's going to happen. And then the other thing that was in the same kind of vein was Pat Robertson referring to CIA agents as like God's angels, that there was some kind of situation where the CIA agents came in last night and did save lives, like it did, but he referred to them as God's, like they are angels who protect us kind of thing. And so it does seem conspiracy, like it does, and I feel crazy like talking about it, but whenever you start reading these things and see these documented instances, you can't help but think that something bigger is going on. And I think about IHOP's political involvement. We had the two leaders that come to the top of my mind right away that were around, that were political leaders, was Sam Brownback and Rick Perry. They did their big response event in Texas. And I don't think people realize the power that happens whenever you have a movement that you wholesale buy into, like the prayer movement. And you get those leaders on a platform with these other political leaders next to them. And you're talking about revival. You're talking about God's purposes. You're talking about these prophecies, these different things. Like, it is manipulation at the end of the day. And that's the heart. And people have trouble because you have to deal with that thing of I've been duped, I think is what it is, that it's hard to reconcile. But I was duped for the majority of my life by that stuff. And then you get into like the voter guide stuff and the organizations who did that. Like it's crazy. Like once you start peeling back the layers, I think you're a whole lot less crazy once I start reading this stuff.
Well, now you're gonna make me geek out, and I said I wasn't gonna go too deep. So I wrote this book, Weaponized Religion: From Latter Rain to Colonia Dignidad, and again, this book could explode into a whole. Actually, it did explode into a whole series that I do called Weaponized Religion, but. The Baron William T. Ferry von Blumberg, who I mentioned was homosexual, who probably wasn't even Christian, they set up fellowship foundations by, I don't know if it's the same name or different names, but in different areas across the globe. He and Branham went around the world doing this. So there's a little bit of, if you're looking for a global operation and you want to do it through religion, well, now you have a global network to do this instantly. One of the networks that he set up, because he was German and had the German influence, was in Germany. He was there with Paul Kane, with William Branham, and they met their security team, which was led by Paul Schaefer. Paul Schaefer went on to found Colonia Dignidad in South America, where there's some insidious things happening there, but they were working with DINA in Chile, which is the equivalent of our DIA, the military CIA. They set up a global operations where from that compound, they were training people how to spy on other people. And they passed out, they planted estimated 50,000 bugs in everybody from Catholic churches, homes, to musicians, to political opponents, etc. And the reason behind it was they believed they were fighting the government branded it World War III, but it was a covert World War III. So they were fighting against communism in South America. And this is largely, if you're talking Contras, this is actually what led to all of this. In fact, some of the people supplying the people in the Iran-Contra affair were in Colonia Dignidad. So it gets really, really sketchy. And they were extracting German political dissents, Nazis, out of Germany into Colonia Dignidad and spreading them throughout South America. It gets really weird whenever I look back at some of the churches that we had in Branhamism. There were churches that had a large concentration of German people. So I'm wondering, well, what all was going on there? Now, I'm not going to go too far with conspiracy theory. I have some suspicions of what's going on there. But what I will say is that everything that I've just said is documented and has now been declassified from Operation Condor. And Richard Nixon, who gave the charge to the people, who was, again, you know, Branham was right there in the room with him. Nixon was part of that global agenda. And it turns into this mess where you can't really say. You look at what happened in Colonia Dignidad, that was very militarized, but were they part of the agenda? Did they know the whole agenda? I don't know. They were definitely, they found chambers underneath the colony where they were torturing and killing political dissents. They had they were teaching them how to make sarin gas, some other things there in the compound. Hitler's Joseph Mengele, the famous torture guy from the Nazi Germany, he was said to have been in the camp. So there's a lot going on. I can't go too far with what that means, other than the fact that once Branhamism shifted to where communism was the enemy, and we need this big end of days revival with this big tent because communism is the beast and it's coming. Well, everyone who was trained under that theology would have thought that helping the government out in World War III, leading to the end of days war against communism, they would have thought this was a good thing. We're gathering together, we're banding together, we're all one Christian body. So I think there's some of that going on, but at the same time, there's a lot of unanswered questions.
That reminded me of what that, so it was a pastor that was captured earlier. That was one of the things that was shocking about that story to me. Whenever you were talking about that, it came back to me, was that two of the people that were there torturing him, like when they were interrogating him, was two people that he recognized from the church networks. And that's whenever he looked up at them and he was like, he called them by name. They start talking and then they start apologizing to him and calling him brother. They're like, brother, we're so sorry. We picked up the wrong person is what it was, is what the story was. And, but to think that that guy was able to just move on because it was his people kind of thing. And that's kind of how they moved on. You bring up Colonia Dignidad. And so like, that was another thing that I was thinking about this week that I was like, man, I want to ask John about this sometime. I was, you know, always looking at organizational structures and different things because they do a whole lot of crazy stuff these leaders do with their tax statuses or their lack of accountability and such. But one that I had never noticed before is we're all familiar with like 501c3s, and you may be unfamiliar with this. I don't know. But 501c3s, we know like typical nonprofit, but I found out that there was a classification called a 501d that was specifically for like religious communities who shared everything and functioned as one unit. Have you heard anything about that with like Branhamism? Because I know that there was a lot of cult compounds and things like that.
Well, in Branhamism, we were taught that the government was the enemy because of the Christian identity themes. And so I know, I won't get into names or anything like this, but I do know that there were some who weren't fully above board in their tax strategies. And some of them did not even have, as far as I know, some of them did not even have a 501c3. I was aware of the D, but I've not dug too deeply to know, and I don't know if you could. I don't know if you could know how many organizations are under this or not, right? But I've not dug too deeply, no.
Yeah, it was just an interesting concept because whenever I was looking at the explanation of it, it was a very like Book of Acts kind of thing. We share everything, have everything in common, and the way that it functioned is almost like a business, but almost like an employee-owned business would be the easiest way, I guess, for people to understand it, is that the whole community shared the profits, but also the losses and everything else, the liabilities, that kind of thing. But it all came under this one central umbrella. I guess kind of as one of our last little forays here is we talked about editing prophecies and talked about leaving things vague, I guess. There is an instance right now that I've been looking at of a prophet who prophesied something in the 90s that was a tragic event that involved the deaths of individuals. And then we fast forward and this thing actually happens about 8, 9, 10 years later, after this person meets someone very influential. It happens about 2 weeks after it, which is kind of ironic that it's in like these networks. But one of the things that we're having trouble doing is we've heard different stories of where this prophecy originated and who prophesied it. But the thing that I'm seeing is that there is a repurposing of prophetic words from Kansas City, different movements in these other offshoot streams. One of the things, which I had mentioned to you before we started recording, I see this idea pop up over and over, and it was shocking to me because as I was reading the one thing transcript, Mike's recruiting people into the House of Prayer movement, telling people that they can do the House of Prayer where they are. He goes through and he lists about six city names. He lists, I'm trying to, these just from memory, the ones I can remember is that he did Orlando, Jacksonville, Denver, Pasadena, which whenever I think like cities to name, Pasadena isn't one that necessarily comes up. I would say LA before I said Pasadena. These different cities like this, who, like, I fast forward now and look at these cities, and these are big House of Prayer hotspots. Denver is a big one. They got the Upper Room Denver. It's where Corey Russell is. Pasadena House of Prayer was a really big one. And I think Paul Kane might have hung out there a little bit for a while. But Pie Hop is what they called it. I actually led worship at one of their conferences once. But yeah, Orlando is another big one. And that leader there is very politically involved. And I think he blocked me on Facebook, if I remember right, because I was asking him about some of his political stuff he was posting. He didn't like it too much. But one of the things that I'm seeing repurposed is those hostile takeovers. We're talking about land grabbing earlier with revivals. And the number five... So the one thing that happened with the Kansas City prophets and what Kansas City called the blueprint prophecy was that there would be five churches, and it would be at the north and the south and the east and the west and one in the center hub. And what they would do is they would go in and use this kind of prophecy as a means of taking over other churches. But it was also this obsession with five. And so, like, I'm seeing this pop up in other offshoots. I don't want to out where I'm seeing it, but I'm seeing it pop up in these other offshoots where it's like a copy paste kind of thing. But I'm also seeing them do the same things that the KCPs did in the 80s and 90s, except they've not gotten caught yet in the way that the KCPs did. So, like with the Kansas City prophets, if you're familiar with that kind of stuff, there was a thing that got strategically titled, we'll say, the Ernie Gruen Report, that was concerns about the aberrant practices of the Kansas City prophets and such. And some of the stuff that's detailed is this kind of thing of the prophets going into these churches and going in with quote unquote good faith. And then next thing you know, they're removing that pastor and inserting their own leaders, different things like that. Do you see stuff like that happen within your cult circles?
There's so much to unpack there. So we're getting towards the end of our time. So I'm going to try to be really quick. First off, a warning to the people in the communities. Whenever you are talking about anything in the quote unquote prophetic realm that involves a death or involves a massive sum of money, don't go there. My warning is just simply don't go there, because there is danger in the water. Don't swim. Second thing, the fives. Man, there are so many fives and threes and twelves and all of these different numbers. I'll never forget when I was reading Irenaeus Against Heresies. He was the first one who walked me through how heretical that is, because the pagan religions relied heavily on these numbers. What is the five? The five are the moon cycles. What is the three? You've got the morning sun, midday sun, dying in day sun. You can go through the entire ancient world with all of these numbers, and you can identify which cults of the ancient world associated these numbers. And Irenaeus said, you've got Christians today that they think they can be more spiritual if they can throw out a three or a five, or, you know, he goes down the list. And that was considered, that was deemed heresy long before the churches that we have today. What happened was Pentecostalism, whenever it began to merge with British Israelism and Christian identity, they were bringing in weird end-of-day themes, some of which involved these numbers, numerologies, and you had these weirdos who were coming into churches with models of the Great Pyramid of Giza, showing how this is a prophetic timeline of the end of days, and therefore doomsday is near. We need our prophets to prophesy. And so what happened is you had this onslaught of doomsday prophecies, which is really, really weird. But what were they doing? They were mixing paganism with Christianity, and they were creating something new. So last part of your question, the hostile takeover. Remember, in the beginning, I talked about this, the movement in general, the strategy was, let's suck everybody out of these apostate churches.
Yeah.
And that ties to the Christian identity theme. They believe that the churches of America had been invaded. And so you had pagan ideas. They were strongly against the evolution idea was one of the big key political things then. So they're saying that you have churches that are forgiving and aren't preaching against the evolutionist. And you had all of this weirdness, which, you know, whether you believe in evolution or you don't believe in it, turning the political part into a doctrine that's preached in a church, it's just kind of, it's not the gospel. I'll just say it like that. So you had this weird politics thing with the intent to suck people out of the mainstream churches and get them so that you can indoctrinate them against the political things that you stand against. That was the purpose and intent. And the question still remains, if it was about God, would you not go to the field and preach to the farmers? Would you not go to travel through the farm communities? Yeah. Same kind of thing is happening here. Which one of these NAR apostles would gladly give up their Cadillacs to go preach to the little farm communities and make sure that they're saved too, make sure they're going to heaven too? You're not going to find a lot of money in a convention there. But if you go to one of the bigger cities, you've got a heck of a lot of money flowing through the organization. B, you've got a large number of people who can come. C, if you're doing the gimmicks like the prayer cards, this weird thing that they're doing. They don't use prayer cards anymore, but you have
Facebook profiles now.
Facebook profile. Not going to name names, but you've got these apostles who are saying, God told me that you live at this street. You know, all of this weirdness. Well, in a big city, that's a heck of a lot easier to do because you can grab a phone book. I mean, if you have I'll say this.
What's a phone book, John? Can you enlighten us?
Well, some of the so-called prophets, I believe, had a perfect memory. And I'm not going to say which, but I think one of them might have been connected to KCF. But I'll let that one go. But anyway, you target where you can make the most money, get the most recognition, get the most power, because it is a game of domination. Think instead of thinking chess, like God's a chess player and he knows how to advance the pieces. Think the opposition, which are these NAR leaders, are playing a game of Risk. Build up my armies in this city, because if I take this, I can dominate this other city. That's kind of what's happening here.
Which ties back into NAR dominionism and everything else. Like, it's all at the end of the day, that's the hard pill to swallow is that you look that I can't see a motivation other than control, whether that's good. I think that can happen with good intent. I think people can maybe be a little slightly deceived and think that they're doing good work by controlling the masses. I mean, I think that's a lot what we see with Christian nationalism. I think people sincerely believe that forcing people into God's ways is helpful for society, but I think it's a little misguided. But this has been really fun. I've enjoyed being able to bounce questions off of you. And maybe if people enjoy this, maybe we can do it again. It's selfishly helpful for me.
Absolutely. Just be sure you take everything that I say with a grain of salt, go look it up and make sure I got it all correct, because I'm trying to do all of this out of memory and I don't have one of these perfect memories. So anyway, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.